Hello and good morning. This is TJ Schwartz. I'm here with Lucas Burnley. You're listening to the Edge and Flow podcast. How you doing, Lucas?
I'm here.
You're here.
I'm a little rough around the edges right now.
Same. And we're going to be rough around the edges as we talk about some knife making things and manufacturing things, trade show things, probably get into the family life around that. And yeah. What we normally talk about, which is just about everything.
Just maybe slightly less
yeah.
energy.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Let's dude, I don't want to talk about show prep.
Yeah.
What can we talk about that's related to show prep without directly acknowledging it?
Yeah, we briefly talked about this earlier this week on the phone for some reason, but it's one of the things I've noticed is like inside the industry, there's these pockets, there's these sectors almost of what you would call spheres of influence. And I've been thinking about it a long time, how there's sort of a blade show bubble. And so shows that fall into the gravitational pull of blade show, or brands that fall into that pull of blade show, they sort of look at blade shows like the pinnacle, and you can kind of see a commonality or like a group mentality around that. You know what I mean? Like brands that show up there, like you've got like a Rick Hinder sized brand, they think about Blade Show as like the peak event of the year. Whereas if you get
not peak, like one, like a 100% necessary show, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, it's kind of like the master gathering of that group of companies, where there's some companies that may go to Blade Show, but for them, it's peripheral. You know what I mean? It's not like they're part of the Blade Show sphere of influence. They just are there sometimes.
Yes.
What are your thoughts on that?
I think where this thought is going is like a really interesting thought, a topic around brands as it relates to our industry, which is like, it's like the gang idea, right?
Yeah,
You can make knives and not be inside of like what you are talking about is like the blade sphere of knives.
Yeah.
Right. And I would say that blade is a really good example, but it probably trickles to like blade is like the culmination of factory and like custom handmade micro brand, kind of everything inside of like one segment of the knife industry. Okay. As shows get smaller, that refines, but it also is like, I think that is like almost like a trickle down effect, right? It's relatable. Then you have like home goods shows, SHOT Show, outdoor retailer. You have this whole other level where like there are knife brands that are not inside of the Blade Show bubble, right? That exist as knife brand. We were actually just talking about one that I think is really cool. And to be completely honest, I don't know that they don't have a booth at Blade. So if they do, like that's just an oversight. But as a company that I was not familiar with, it's a kitchen knife called New West Knife Works. Recently, I saw a set of them at a friend's house. They're super nice. They're like very obviously like small batch made, and they're American made. And I was like, how do I not know about, like, how do you not know about an American knife company is like kind of the thought.
Yeah.
It's because they're not inside of that bubble.
Yeah, exactly.
Right.
Well, it's weird because like you've been in the industry 20 plus years, for me 10 plus years, you almost get this false feeling that you're like, yeah, I know all the American companies.
Yeah, totally.
And then you just go wander out somewhere and like you see this random knife store in this small town or something. You're like, I've never, what? And it's like you realize that we are in more of a bubble than we think we are. And I'm like, I think that's part of the conversation is like noticing the fact that we are in a sphere and that there's other regions of the industry as a whole.
Well, and I guess my question for you would be like, you're developing a production brand, right?
Mm-hmm.
What do you, when you look at that, what do you see? Because I've actually said in the past, I'm like, yeah, we're in a bubble. I've done things to try to, like, you know, kind of like push outside of, that's why I love doing apparel and stuff. It's like, I feel like it's sometimes it's like a little bit of a push outside of just our direct industry. EDC is in our industry, but it also pushes outside of a little bit too. But I realize I'm like, I've worked really, really hard to build a following, to build a brand inside of what essentially is this bubble. Right.
Yeah.
How do you see it?
The way I think about it is the blade bubble feels like the bubble that's about knives, because it's not a tactical bubble. It's not a culinary bubble. It's not an outdoors bushcraft bubble. It's the knife bubble. But I think what I'm learning is the other bubbles are like overlanders, bushcrafters, hunters, where they're not knife collectors per se, but they're extremely knife oriented
because the activity benefits from knives.
So you'll go to if you go to like Overland Expo, it's like a knife company that's set up there, or some big hunting expo, a knife company that's set up there that's targeting hunters, like Montana Knife Company is an example. You know, they don't go as far as I know to Blade Show yet. I don't know if they're gonna be there this year, but it seems like they're an example of like, everyone in the knife industry knows about them, but they're partying with the hunters. They're not, you know,
they're not leveraging the knife industry knife buyer to be the avenue for selling their product. They're going after like the hunting, fishing, like I think like industry term is like people say like hook and bullet.
Yeah.
Right. It's like, that would be like the sector. Yeah. And a lot of that customer base is not, like you said, not knife specific, but they have the disposable income to be able to afford the product, and they have a hobby or passion that makes that product valuable.
And another example of this is I've been really thinking about getting into scuba diving, and I've always wanted to, but there's a shop here in Boise, a couple shops with scuba gear. And I was walking into one, just looking around, and they had a glass cabinet with a bunch of knives. And they're dive knives,
dude.
And there's brands, and they're
different brands.
There's brands in there that I've never heard of. You know what I mean?
And so it's I bet I'm more familiar. Dive knives are super interesting to me. Mm. I feel like there was a time in custom knives or like knife collecting where dive knives were a bigger thing. Mm. Just because they are badass.
Yeah.
It's almost like if you say like Rambo knife, you're like, okay, that's like set in time, right? You're like Lyle design, huge combat knife. There was a time period where there were like dive knives that kind of fit into that late 80s, 90s.
Yeah. Dude, like a dive knife motif almost.
Like a dive knife as like, like if you were almost to like take dive knife DNA and put it into
like a boot knife.
Yeah, that would be like Tecna. Are you familiar with Tecna?
Not really.
Okay.
No.
So T-E-K-N-A. Just look up Tecna dive knives when we get off, and you'll see you're like, they made a dive knife, they made a boot knife. It was the same knife. One had like a sick injection molded locking sheath, one had a leather sheath with a clip. But like design language wise, they're awesome, but it's like Coast and like, did you track any of the names?
Honestly, I don't remember. I kind of had a passing look at the knives because I was there to look at scuba gear, but I need to go back.
I think you do. I think that also like brings in like a complete side quest thought, but the idea of being involved in product design, manufacturing, development, I think there's a lot of value on an individual level of having hobbies that are kind of like high gear requirement. When you told me you went to the scuba shop, I was like, yeah, that tracks. That makes like the most sense of anything. As I'm like messing
except for
with
the fact that
compound
I live in
bows.
Idaho.
Yeah. No. But honestly, it does. Like that's the you have like high aspen lakes, right? I would imagine that's like where the diving is happening.
Yeah, well, I got a kick out of it, dude, because so yes, we do have a lot of Clearwater lakes, but I was on one of the website pages for like the instructional courses here in Boise. There's two kind of competitors, and on one of them it was like a FAQ thing, and it's like the number one was like, where do you dive in Idaho? It's like, short answer, we don't.
And then, that's great.
And I was like, oh, okay. The only problem is the Clearwater lakes in Idaho are cold, so that
it's not a problem.
Yeah,
you can overcome it with more gear.
You can
dude,
you can.
Tom from Blue Collar, who is now, that business has been rebranded, but he's like a super avid diver.
Nice.
He's like out in the Bahamas a lot. Mm. I see like really cool pictures. He's someone you could pull on for,
yeah, I should,
for some, you know, inspiration.
Absolutely.
Enablement. Yes. Perhaps.
Yes.
First piece of gear. Oh, I've got some old gear I could hook you up with.
Yeah, like, there we go.
It's always, first one's always free.
Yeah. Diving, you know.
Okay. That was like a tangent, but I think it tracks. Like I would guess for you to also, like, because of the type of product that you were making and the fact that you're actually able to produce it in an amount that can satisfy some type of markets that are activity driven are probably really enticing to you.
Mm-hmm. Right? Yes. And that's like,
you want the LT5 to get used for its purpose. You're not like, oh, I'm psyched to, like, yeah, I sold a bunch of knives and this knife goes in someone's safe and is like part of a collection.
Yeah. And that's exactly the thread I'm pulling on, is that, like, I love selling knives to knife collectors because they have a respect for knives that's different than the users, in that
totally.
There's these like aspects of like our MagnaCut knives that it's like a user may not notice, but a collector would, which is, you know, cool. But then at the same time, when you get into those spheres where it's like they're buying knives specifically to use them, to me, I get like a great satisfaction from that. I just got an email from a guy who's up in Kodiak, Alaska, who bought an
LT5. I read that post. Yeah.
And I was just like, I'm just so happy to hear like that he was using it in the woods, you know, way up there. And just, I get an email like that every once in a while where somebody will say, hey, I'm in Mexico, I'm going to fly to India for my next trip. I'm like traveling around the world.
Yeah.
Like, he was asking how I could ship him a knife and it would get to him. Like, should it be in India or should it be in Mexico? Blah, blah, blah. But like the thought of my knife going with him on his like journey and specifically to be used is just an amazing feeling. And I'm starting to think, while still being in love with the Blade Show bubble, starting to think more about like, where are the touchstones and where are the people gathering who are users?
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And it's a different frame of mind that I'm starting to try to wrap my head around.
Yeah. I think it's really fun. This kind of tracks with Zach's video that he did on you, which is like, this knife maker does everything backwards.
Yeah.
I would make the argument that a lot of us on like the handmade side started really making knives that were used a lot. Mm-hmm. Okay. When I think back, I was primarily like tactically inspired, right? At that point, I was doing a lot of combatives training. I was doing a lot of martial arts. It's what I liked visually from like the knife industry. When I was getting into it, I liked tactical knives. And I had those same emails. And like, I've got letters from customers. And like, I remember when I brought out the first Quiken with like the, you know, the ripcord, right? I got some letters from like police officers and stuff. And like, one of them was basically like, hey, like, I was in my vehicle and something happened and basically like used the Quiken and like stuck it in somebody's forearm.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, that was the whole point of that. You had the knife appendix carry.
Yeah.
You did it. You did the thing and the tool did the thing. And that is, you're like, oh, that like might've saved someone's life. And that is an amazing, amazing feeling. And then you move forward and forward and forward. The demand becomes higher, the collectability becomes higher, all of those things, and the knives stop getting used as much.
Mm-hmm.
It's almost backwards. Like,
yeah,
you're doing it with volume, right? But you're already integrated into the knife industry because of your because of your factory design work. Mm-hmm. It would have been really easy for you to just transition into like high end pieces that like it's mostly being collected, and you went the other way.
Yeah. And there's something with me that really, really interests me in going the other way.
Yeah.
Going with looking at what someone is doing with a knife and designing it for that. And then the kicker there is you have to have the volume, the efficiency, and the affordability for it to be realistic. You know what I mean? Because if it's like collector level prices, there's people that will use them, and collector level scarcity, people will still use the knives.
Yeah.
But that's not like the true deep likelihood of what you're actually doing with all that your work. You know what
even
I mean?
even with the full intent of use, it's mm-hmm. like, well, and I would say there are levels. Like you mm-hmm. mentioned Rick Hinder earlier.
Yeah.
I think his brand is actually a great example of this, which is the product is nice enough that it can be a collection, and it is. And the demand, like you remember like Rick's table getting pushed over at Blade Show, I don't know, decade ago.
Yeah.
Like lottery's huge, like the demand is there. And then, but you still see knives that are used completely like scratched up, ground down, like it's used like a tool. And I love that it can exist in both spaces.
Yes, I agree. Right? Yeah. And when I say user, it's like you can go down to where it's like literally like disposable level usability, which I don't want to go there. But it's like going down to where it's like someone who likes to buy things that are going to last them a lifetime, but are also going to use it, where that price point justifies it in being able to use it and sometimes abuse it, but not so expensive or not so cheap that it's like, you know, disposable. Like, and well, that's like a lifetime tool, but still a tool.
Lifetime. Dude, it's funny. I, for a long time, I really struggled, and I do in a way, like when I was making a lot of like combat knives, my idea was almost like, man, I would love to do this with an injection molded handle and just make it like super durable, like well-made, but like inexpensive. And it's like, I couldn't do that at that time. And I didn't have a skill set that would allow it. Now I would be like closer to being able to figuring that out. Right. Are you familiar with Mission knives?
Ooh, probably, but I can't remember what the
knife that's like kind of a fun one. Maybe it's like a walk around, like an Atlanta walk around for you if you get a little chance. Which I think you and I, if we can do it, we should still try to get like a walk. I know you got your booth, but at some point we got to do a walking tour.
Yeah, we should.
Mission knives make like titanium dive knives, right? They use beta titanium. They've been around forever. But that it was like injection molded over like a thick chunk of tie or steel.
Mm-hmm.
And I loved them. I find quality in that, but it's not like, it's almost like the polymer pistol versus like a really nice 1911 kind of thing.
Yeah.
You're like, this feels like it will do the job. It's just not like it's not refined in that way.
Yeah. Yeah.
I don't know. I think
it checks all the boxes functionally.
Checks all the boxes. Yeah.
But there's like an element that's missing when you're not feeling like a wood grip with a steel framed handle. But it's like, I know exactly what you're saying.
Dude, Mora knife, it hits that for me.
Yeah.
Mora knife is like, dude, they're like $30. And you pick them up and this is just a tool, like,
mm-hmm.
and they're like really thoughtfully designed. I ended up, when I did that Human Nature Hunting School, I ended up wearing a Mora knife like 90% of the time past a certain point, because I was like, oh man, it's so lightweight. It did everything I needed it to do. It wasn't super precious, but I didn't feel like, it's not disposable either.
Yeah, yeah.
So really, there's a really fine balance there. I think right now, dude, like watching you with the LT5, I don't think people have figured out like what that actually is, like from the standpoint of how high of quality in relation to the price. That it's crazy to me.
Well, I appreciate it. And I do agree with you. I think that knife has yet to, I mean, I agree with you in that the word hasn't really got out yet. We haven't really, we're not a marketing enterprise over here.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I'm waiting to see like when some reviewers like pick it up and start to see and use and,
well, just, and I'm it. Curious to see like how it's perceived, because like when you think about what a $185 knife is in the market, a like small batch US made product is not the first thing that comes to mind.
Right.
Right. Like the Kydex that you're doing on that knife, the quality of the Kydex, if you go to a Kydex maker, that sheath is probably $60. Like what you're doing is actually like a market upset. Dude, I'm excited.
I'm excited too. Well, thank you.
I'm excited to get one.
Yeah, no, you have one. You just have to come to Blade Show and pick it
up. Ooh, even better.
Yeah.
Okay.
Heck yeah.
Okay, we're like tangenting. I'm fine with that, dude. My brain, I'm like smoked right now. I've gone nonstop. I'm on home stretch. Like, I'm starting to talk about blade prep. What else? Where do we want to go? Can we talk about Kihoku for a minute?
Yeah. Let's talk about that.
What do you want to know? Ask me some questions.
So you sent me a picture.
Yes.
Of a tray of knives that looks to me like they're ready to go in a box.
They're ready. Yeah. So run started out with 12 pieces. Okay. I finished 9 of them. And 3 of them had some type of problem, basically. I finished all 12, but basically I got out of those, I got 9 knives that are perfect. Mm-hmm. There's some like, this is a sprint run. There's like some minor variations, like on the jimping on a couple of them, it's a larger jimping. And then I switch sizes. So like, this is an atypical batch.
Yeah,
but that was kind of always the plan, which was like, okay, I'm going to figure out all of the details as I work through this first batch.
To steal a referencing from John Grimsmo, they're the artist proof batch in a way.
Yeah, it's basically an artist proof, right? Yeah. Which in the future will get a new logo, which is I think kind of fun. Mm-hmm. I've done it in the past where I used to do a run of knives. Like when I would develop a fixed blade, I would do a run completely by hand just to like make the batch. And those would always be numbered like one of, and that's how, you know, it was like the initial batch.
Yeah.
Right. There's only a few batches that have that. So yeah, man, Kihoku is done. Insane amount of work to fit inside. I looked and it's like, it basically was almost a month start to stop. I'm very glad that I was able to finish the parts that I had and then stop, because what I was seeing was that towards the end, I was still in like problem solving, but I was like, I was making, there are things that I want to go back now and update about the machining process, things that I want to have more tooling for, or like more supplies for, and actually having like a little bit of a break between, I think really is going to let that like settle in and let me make decisions based on what I want versus like what I need to get done.
Yeah. Oh, 100%.
But yeah, dude, it feels really good for me. Like the Blade Show bubble, there is something about showing up to Atlanta with a new model that feels like really good and like the way it's supposed to be done.
Yeah.
Does that like track?
And that is a hallmark of us being in that Blade Show bubble. Is that it's like, if you're gonna do some release, some like initial public offering, Blade Show is like the premier place to do it.
Yeah.
And I agree 100%.
Well, it's, you know, I was like, Maddie, I was like, I know the run's really small. I was like, should I post up a few of these in the group? And she was like, I know why you want to do that. And I know that you want to like take care of people who aren't going to go to a show. She's like, this run of knives, she's like, needs to go to Atlanta. Mm-hmm. She's like, you can do that. She's like, do that next. She's like, but this run like took so much to get done. She's like, give it to the people that are at the show. Mm-hmm. And it's that same thing. It's like, cause it's the same. I would say it's the same for collectors, but shifting, but it's essentially, it's like, it's the big show, right? You've got people coming in from all over the world. And like the idea that you can get something there that you can't get anywhere else, I think is a real like value add.
Yeah.
Yeah. Right.
That's absolutely true.
So, yeah, man, I had sent you a message. One of the biggest realizations in the Kihoku process, is the, it is efficient, right? Like it's even in its like R&D, like hacked together phase right now, it is efficient. Putting that into my system right now was really tricky. Cause I was like, just the volume of just like parts and like, where do I, like, okay, I gotta like, I have to like lay out all these parts in a way. Like, oh, where do I get table space to do that? And like, mm-hmm. cause everything I've been working on is like onesie, twosie, like prototype or like make a custom, two customs. And I just saw, I'm like, wow, if I doubled or tripled the size of this batch, I'm immediately, my solutions aren't good enough.
Yeah. Yeah. You're coming right into the territory that we found out, which is like you design your shop and you almost forget, where do you put the knives?
Yeah.
You know what I mean? It's yeah. like, you don't realize, like you think about numbers and you think about the cycle times on machines and what you're yeah. going to need. And then you're like, okay, well, 50 knives on a table.
Right.
That's a big table.
It's a big table. You know? Well, and actually, I mean, you bring up a point, which is really great, dude. I don't think about cycle times. That is not the way that I have used the CNC up until now is very much just like another custom knife making tool. Mm-hmm. I have never worried about if my feeds and speeds are efficient. Mm-hmm. I have never worried about like optimizing. It's like I go, I make the things I want to make. Yeah, maybe I'm running a little bit slow. Doesn't matter. I actually got super interested during this project of like refining those things. Like I got the hook got in me mm-hmm. a little bit where mm-hmm. I was like, oh, this is why all the machinist folks are like constantly talking about this.
Yeah.
Right.
Right.
Because yeah. it's actually pretty sticky.
Yeah. And it's like, if you're doing custom one-off and a lot of different random, like job yeah. shoppy stuff. And like what a lot of what you've been doing up to now, it's like all of the time is spent programming, designing, setting up, getting the material prepped. And it's like the difference between an 8 minute cycle time and an 18 minute cycle time is like that 10
minutes.
You don't even notice it.
You can yeah, do anything once, right? Yeah, like that's the, yeah.
Yeah, but if you like, okay, you do this huge process to get everything ready. Now you're ready to hit cycle start like 100 times in a row. 10 minutes times 100.
Yeah.
Oh, that's out.
It's a like long days. It's like, interesting. One thing I did, I would kind of tell you my cycle times and you'd be like, oh yeah, that's like long. Like you'll be able to get that down. One of them was around scales. I think I was at like 18 minutes or something. And I was like, man, that's amazing. Like I can make like a set of scales in 18 minutes and this is great. Dude, I shaved it in half. Mm-hmm. And I was like, but like that felt like magic. And I was like, oh, it's just cause I was like missing. I was missing something, like missing chip load or like something. I was like,
some wasted movement somewhere. Yeah.
Yeah. There was some movement that just didn't need to mm-hmm. be there. So, can I tell you about the name? Did I tell you about the name?
You told me about the name, but definitely okay. share.
All right. So this knife is based on my Kihon. Kihon was a folder that I did that was kind of meant to like really, it was in like tactical mindset, EDC, but like really stripped down, super functional, right? Had external like stop pin, like really like tough knife. And Kihon in Japanese is means basics. It's like a kata also in martial arts. So I designed this fixed blade based on the Kihon and I kept calling it like the Kihon Field or the KF or like, I was like, man, it doesn't feel right. So the name that I ended up on is Kihoku, which is like combining Kihon with the Japanese word for north, which I think is pretty cool. It's a totally made up word, but I think like as a signifier, it really fits like the concept of like a field knife, like directionality. Like,
well, Kihoku, that's a very Burnley sounding name.
It sounds Burnley, so. Right?
Yeah. Yeah. It is.
I love made up names so much because you're not fighting like a word.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. No, I think made up names are, I have not done a lot. I've done a couple, but like, it's getting to the point where it's almost necessary. You know what I mean? Yeah. And then when you start to do it, there's some fun in that for sure.
I think there's some fun. And again, like, I was like looking, I'm like, I want like a couple syllables, you know, like, I don't know how much value there is in a name of a product. The lesson for me was like naming my Quiken folder Quiken was like not probably the best idea because it just is too, it's like naming a big camp knife Bowie.
Mm-hmm.
Like it's actually really ubiquitous.
Yeah.
And doesn't like separate it.
Yeah. No, I get that. Yeah. It's naming is really, I think there's some magic, some swagger in a name.
Yeah.
That is weird. It's weird because it's like, if it has too much swagger, it's almost like you're trying too hard.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Yeah. So it's like, it's almost cringy if it's like too cool.
Right.
I don't know. Yeah. It's a
And also like, I think they apply to the audience. Like there are names that I think give it an appeal to a certain group.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Like it's like a naming convention that fits inside of a subcategory.
Yeah. Right? It's like you might see like the Dragon's Breath Death Saber. And then it's like someone else would name that, you know, the Shadow. Something simpler.
Right.
You know what I mean? It's like you can go all different.
But like also if you're like Renfair, like that Dragon's Breath, dude, that's sick.
Yeah,
like,
exactly.
I do want that. Like you know, LT5, like you're right there. You're like already kind of appealing to like this like simple, maybe like survival minded, military minded, outdoor minded, where it's like really like, okay, this is gear driven. Here's the name of this piece of equipment.
Yeah, and the big thing is like with that, it's like a scalable name because it's like if I don't put a number on it, I'm gonna have to come up with a bunch more names very soon.
Oh,
but if
yeah.
I put the number on it, I only need one name, right? So it's like that.
I would like an LT10.
An LT10. There you go.
Yes. Dude, I love big knives so much.
I don't have a whole lot of experience with them, so I need to start to play with that.
It's so satisfying. I bought at Billy Cho's PNWCI show last year, I bought a like an 8-inch or 9-inch knife from Nick Rossi.
Mm-hmm.
Dude, I love it. It's like light and fast. It's a camp knife, kind of Bowie shaped, but like it just feels
fantastic.
Yeah. Like, and they work. Like if you have to do big knife work, you can do like when we were dressing out turkeys, I like handed this to somebody because they were like using a small knife. I was like, oh, like, and it was fun because like the people in that course were not knife people at all.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was like the look that he gave me was basically like, giving me like the Conan sword.
Yeah.
And I was like, yeah, but a big knife, like a well-designed big knife can do little knife work.
Yeah.
And he was in there and he was like basically like boning out wings. And I was like, he's like, wow, this works really good. Good job, Nick.
Yeah.
Big knife.
There you go.
Big knife energy.
All right.
LT10.
LT10. LT14, dude. Might as well. Yeah.
But big, you know what? The funny thing about big knives is like the dual category of them, which is like big, thick, heavy chopper, big, light, and then like the balance point in between those. I mean, we've talked about Adam and Haley DeRozier before, and like Jason Knight, we talk about a lot. When they make big stuff, you pick it up and you're like, it's deceptively light and fast. And then you'll look and you're like, the spine is 5/16 of an inch thick.
Mm-hmm.
But it's like distally tapered and you're like, you could fully take down a tree with that thing.
Yeah.
But it also feels like it just wants to eat. Like it's lightweight. Yeah. And like, but you're like, yeah, it's deceptive.
Yeah. Yeah. No, there's
recently, the thing that came to mind that makes this like a good tie-in would be like counterbalances on bows. You're adding weight, but you're making the thing feel more balanced, more stable.
Yeah.
Or I guess, is it a stabilizer? I guess they call them stabilizers.
I don't know. I'm not the right guy.
Yet.
Yeah. I tell you about scuba weights.
Dude, tell me about scuba. Let's hear it. What did you find out about scuba? I want to hear about it.
So I've been obsessed with scuba since I was in elementary school, and it was probably third grade. There's a sixth grade kid that I always looked up to. He was like the coolest kid in the school to me, because his dad was in search and rescue. And he learned to scuba dive in sixth grade, and he brought all of his scuba gear for show and tell one day. And the sixth grade kid, when I'm in like second or third grade, is just pulling out of this duffel bag, like, here's my tank, my mask.
Sick. Yeah.
And I remember sitting there like, I cannot believe what I'm seeing.
Basically,
you know what I mean?
Just like, an astronaut.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's like a kid doing it, because before that you think about like, oh yeah, that's for like G.I. Joe and like, you know, Marines and stuff. And then you see the sixth grade kid doing it, and I became obsessed. And between that day and about when I was like maybe 16, I wanted to be like an oceanographer or like some sort of ocean studying, like submersible scuba diving. Like that basically captivated me for like 15 years after that, or 10 years maybe.
Hard in Idaho. And
what's that?
Hard in Idaho. You're not going tide pooling. Like, yeah, you're not fueling the fire.
But that's the ultimate like damp cloth that like doused the flame, was like, there's just nowhere to go. And so I basically decided to, well, I didn't decide to, but life happened and I ended up not ever getting certified or anything. And then it just occurred to me, like, I just turned 30, like, I don't know, 2 weeks ago. And I was like, it's time. Like, I need to scuba dive. And so I'm going to go get
your birthday. Happy birthday.
Oh, thanks, man. No worries.
30. Oh, 30. Dude.
The big one. The whopper.
30 and 40 have been my favorite birthdays. Mm-hmm. I feel like at 30, my life made a lot more sense. And this is weird. I don't know if like everyone has these like feelings on age, but I felt like there was a point in my life where I was just like, I was too young to like be living the way that I was almost. And then when I was 30, I was like, oh yeah, this makes sense. This is sick. Mm-hmm. I don't know.
Yeah.
You make a good 30-year-old, dude.
Oh, well, thanks.
Okay. So when are you getting certified?
So I'm thinking August. They have some openings. It's like kind of the last chance, because you have to do open water swimming, diving to like get certified. And in Idaho, like, better get it done in August.
Better get it done.
Yeah.
Yeah. I was going to say, like, it should be like your active recovery from Atlanta.
Yeah.
But that's perfect, because it's like you come back from Atlanta, you get back into the swing, you work two months. You do that, then you have 2 months until Blade West.
Yep.
So it's like splitting, because then it's like, it's like active recovery, but also like pre-coping for the next show prep.
One also funny aspect to that is, after that kid brought the scuba gear in, I think I asked my parents for scuba gear for Christmas for like four or five straight years. And I just thought, like, they can just go to the store and they can just buy me some scuba gear and put it under the tree, and I just go scuba diving. And and then I'd be on eBay. That was like the beginning of eBay, you know what I mean, when it was like Wild West eBay. And I was like on there trying to find like Google, like search scuba gear, filter it to like cheapest first, and be like, there it is, $80, like that's all, you know.
Like, and done.
I had like books and stuff, but I just almost forgot. Like, it was like when I turned 30, it was almost like I remembered. I was like, I forgot about that a little bit.
Dude, that's it's actually pretty nice. I've always been really bad about doing like weird things around time, where I'm like, oh, I missed that, or like, I'm gonna stop doing this because I'm like too old. And I've gotten better about just being like, oh, nope, I'm starting this now, because if I start it now, I'll get X amount of years to like do this thing. And also, having kids really, I think, helps that thought process. How old are your kids now?
2 and 4.
Nope. 2 and 4. Okay. So four, yeah, four is like where it started with Bo, where like you start to do like some different like side by side stuff. Mm-hmm. So you don't know, like I was gonna ask, like, how are you with like gear for your kids and like activities for your kids and stuff? But I don't know that you would fully know yet.
Yeah, yeah, it's very early, but this summer with Delta is definitely where we're starting to see her get excited about a lot of things. We got
what
a
is
big,
Delta into?
She is kind of into everything, honestly. She's just excited in general. She's in T-ball right now. She's kind of into that. I think she likes it, but just because it's different. I don't know if it's going to be very sticky, but she really likes, we got a big tandem kayak, like big, like
float,
like boarding up on canoe size, so that all four of us can go in there. And she loved that. So it's been kind of chilly, honestly, even this far late into the spring, it's usually warmer, but so we need to get that out more.
It's fun, man. I don't know. It Winston right now, he's not like, he's like fully engaged in Legos. Dude, this is from a design standpoint, it's really weird. So Bo loves Legos, mm-hmm. but it was like superhero Legos to start. Okay. And then it went into Harry Potter Legos.
Yeah.
Okay. Winston likes Ninjago Legos, but Bo never got into Ninjago. And I'm like, it's a couple year difference.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm like, it's just interesting the way that like the trends work. Now Bo is like, because of school, Bo is like super interested in Minecraft. Mm-hmm. And he's 7. Like he hasn't played video games at all. Like he hasn't, you know, hasn't done that. And he's like, I want to play Minecraft. And I'm like, okay, like we can look at that. I don't know. It's just interesting the way that like the hobbies and flows. Bo and I are still doing, we're doing archery twice a week. And that one has been like, that's like the first one where I'm like buying him gear and thinking about his gear. And what I'm noticing is like, I'm basically just buying him stuff that I would want for myself.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I will probably be a gear dad where I'm like, his bow is pretty sick. Like his case is sick. And I'm like, I'm going to figure out how to build him a little like, you know, stabilizer for it. And I'm like, mm-hmm. oh, that's cool. Like I can do like a knurled aluminum stabilizer and like, just like, I don't know. It's fun dad stuff.
Yeah, no, I'm excited for that. Yeah, we're just kind of on the horizon now of that life. You know what I mean? Wilson obviously trails behind. He's just he digs in the mud and throws things. So
it's good, man. Winston just turned 4, and I'm like, man, you're like big. I've been boxing with him.
Yeah.
And that, like, we box before bedtime, and I just do, like, I basically just do boxing drills where just I let them hit my hands.
Yeah.
Dude, and they love it so much.
Yeah.
And just, like, I'm just, like, we just hang out and do combos. And I'm, like,
out a little bit.
Yeah, wear them out. They feel good because they got, like, all this, like, energy. And I'm, like, and I feel like a lot of times it's, like, toning kids, you know, like, hey, like, chill. Like, okay, that's not, like, where we're at right now. And sometimes then it's just like, especially like that before bed, you're like, no, they're going to get wound up. And it's like, no, it like at least with our kids, like it regulates them.
Yeah.
They'll do that for 5 minutes. They're psyched and then they're ready for bed.
Yeah. 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 Just like expel that last little bit of energy and then they just crash. Yeah. Definitely works. Yeah. The kids, they like chasing me. So
yeah,
we have like laminate floors through the whole house. So if I wear socks, it's very hard to run in the house, you know? And if they're barefoot, they can like almost catch me because they can go around
little
corners.
Sticky little feet.
Yeah.
Yeah, so you need some hospital socks.
Yeah. So it's actually like a legit effort to like run away from them.
That's pretty fun. Yeah. It's good. Good stabilizer muscles.
Yeah.
Do you wrestle with them?
Yeah. Oh yeah.
Yeah. I like doing they try to keep me down. So I'll start on the ground and I'm like, okay, your job is to like not let me get up. And then we'll do the other one. Like, okay, you guys have to pull me down to the ground.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like just interesting to see like where like their balance and like weight changes are and like they figure out like teaming up and stuff. Like it's pretty good.
That's good.
Yeah. Well, I know you got people coming into town, right? So you're on a short timeline.
Yeah.
That's nice.
Yeah, my parents are rolling through. Yeah, we should probably wrap it up, but that was a really great conversation.
Dude, nice little break. Next time we talk. It will be post Atlanta. I'm sure we will have takeaways and thoughts. Yeah, guys, thanks for listening. Yeah. Thanks for your support on Patreon.
Thank you guys. And if you are going to be at Blade Show, this episode should drop the Monday before Blade. So if you hear this, come look us up.
Yep. I will be at a table. I will be at Tom Crine's table on Saturday. I'm basically doing a pop-up. TJ has his own booth. Would love to meet some of you guys. Just like come up and say hi, please. So yeah, cool. All right, man. Safe travels.
Peace.
And good luck with the rest of the work.